For people on the Adobe Connect, we'll probably get started in 2-3 minutes. All right, I think we'll get started here. Thanks, everyone, and welcome to the Competition, Consumer Trust, and Consumer Choice Review Community Engagement Session. I will note for those not in the room or on the phone that MP3s will be made available to you afterward for you to submit your input. And where do I point this? It's the arrow, right?
Hit the setup for your remarks. You should have plenty of range.
Okay. We're having a slight technical difficulty with the slides. The IT department said that I should have plenty of range, even though I'm a baritone, in order to handle this session. So by way of background, there's the beginnings of some slides. Okay. Well, this is feels like slide 6 or something, though.
No, it's not.
Slide 2. It is slide 2?
Yes.
Oh, okay. All right. Oh, I see. All right. Thanks, everyone. Welcome back. So the review on consumer trust, consumer choice, and competition was one of the reviews mandated by the affirmation of commitments and is part of the accountability proposal to be built into the bylaws going forward. And so we were asked to review the degree to which the new GTLD program has promoted competition, consumer trust, and consumer choice, and as well as the effectiveness of the application processes and then as well as the safeguards. So that's sort of the overall concept behind the review. Next slide. Uh, So as you can see here, there's a review team made up of 17 people, and there's some geographic distribution here on the screen from where folks are from. There are four experts, independent experts. There's a representatives of the ICANN CEO and the chair of the GAC as part of the team, and the rest are members of the community, which we'll see in the next slide. So next slide. So you can see here sort of the distribution. Over on the left is the SOAC representatives. You can see there's representatives from the JNSO, ALAC, GAC, and CCNSO. There's independent experts, and then the representatives of the CEO and the chair of the GAC. Okay, next slide. So we divided the work into, Okay. We divided the work into three sub-teams, one that will deal with competition and choice, one that deals with consumer trust and safeguards, and the other with the application and evaluation process. So, so next slide. And so we have a basic work plan laid out here, which is that we are this month determining the issue areas, and that's part of why we've asked you here, is to help with defining the issue areas that we'll be covering. We're going to be requesting some additional data sets. For those that don't have the background in this, there's been some data collection that has occurred over the past couple of years that will help this review, and there's also been phase one studies, economic study, and phase one registrant survey and an end user survey. So you'll see that here in May, the phase two consumer survey results will be published. In June, the phase two economic study results will be published. And then we're hoping then to issue some interim recommendations so that some of the PDP working groups that are working on the policy development surrounding potential subsequent new GTLDs will be able to incorporate some of our findings. We would issue final findings, and then we will put a draft up for a public comment along with some recommendations. I guess that's what Republic is meant to be, is recommendations for public comment, and then finally deliver the final report probably mid-year next year. So without further ado, we divided up into sub-teams, and so we have three sub-team chairs. Jordan Buchanan is heading up the competition and consumer choice sub-team. Lorraine Capon is heading up the trust and safeguard sub-team, and I'm heading up the application and evaluation process sub-team. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce Jordan Buchanan to go through some of the high-level topics associated with competition and consumer choice, and then open that up for discussion. Jordan, go ahead.
Thanks, Jonathan. In order to help plan our work, we've, as Jonathan pointed out in the overall work plan, the Competition and Consumer Choice subteam has tried to identify an issue set that we'll be focusing on. And we've done this by basically posing questions that we think that we'd like to answer during the course of the review. And we've spent some time developing that list of questions. This is not intended to be every question that could ever be answered about competition and consumer choice, but rather the ones that we think are both most germane and most important to answer, as well as those that we feel like that we're going to be able to get adequate information on in order to answer, and that we'll have time over this course of the review in order to answer as well. And so as part of this exercise, we've also gone through and tried to prioritize topics into either high priority or lower priority. And so I'm going to start off by running through the questions that we've identified as being high priority. And this is an area where we'd really like feedback from the community. Do we have the right set of issues that we're looking at? If we don't, it's great to hear it now so that we can focus our work over the next, as Jonathan mentioned, over the next few weeks and months, we'll be using this set of questions that we're trying to answer in order to determine what's the data that we need. An important part of this exercise is that we want this review to be very data-driven, to be based on objective measures as opposed to just putting our fingers in the air and hoping that we come up with good answers based on our opinions. And in order to do that, we have to have the right set of data, and it can often be somewhat time-consuming in order to do so. And there's already two studies that have been done in order to support this work. First one by analysis group looking at the competitive aspects, and secondly by Nielsen looking at it's a survey on consumer behavior, and those are about to go into a second phase where they're going to ask some of the same questions and follow up on some additional data as well. We're trying to hone those follow-up analyses right now, and so we really need to get these questions right if we're going to do that. So I'll run briefly through the key questions that we've identified, and then I think we'll pause and have an opportunity for the community to give us feedback on whether we're heading in the right direction or not. So in the area of competition, we've identified sort of five key questions that we're trying to answer. And the first two, I think, are hopefully fairly obvious. It's, has the GTLD, the introduction of new GTLDs through the 2012 round, has it been effective at promoting price competition in particular? Are consumers, or registrants in particular, are they seeing lower prices as the result of the introduction of these new GTLDs? Similarly, we want to know, has the introduction of GTLDs been effective at promoting non-price competition? And there you could think about, are there registries offering new features? Are users excited by these names that they can use instead of the existing TLDs that were available to them in the past, and choosing them because the nature of the name is different or exciting? In this area, we would look and see whether or not we'd seen competition for factors other than price. And in fact, one early result that we've noticed is that in many of these new GTLDs, prices are higher than in a lot of the legacy GTLDs. And so that, you know, that would imply that there's some other reason why that consumers are choosing these. We want to look into whether that's been an effective mechanism of competition as well. The third question we're looking at is probably the trickiest one, and that's essentially, when you talk about competition, you're generally talking about competition in a particular market, competition between who and to sell what, and it's going to be very challenging, I think, to figure out exactly what the market that we're talking about for the purposes of competition are. Is each TLD its own market? Does a registrant come wanting to buy a domain in a particular top-level domain name, and then really it's just like a matter of which registrar are you choosing because you're stuck with one registry? Or is a registrant, you know, in a particular geography, or maybe they're choosing between the local CCTLD and a set of GTLDs? Or maybe, you know, someone wants to start a photography website or something like that, and there's certain topical TLDs that might constitute the market of domains that they're interested in. And this is actually an area which we have some wise economists on our team, and they've basically suggested that we're probably not actually going to get a definitive answer to this question. Instead, what we'll do is we'll say, if you think about the market as being this way, here's what the results of the marketplace look like. Here's how the competitive effects would shake out. And so we'll have a few different approaches that I think we take in terms of thinking about this question of what the market looks like. The fourth question we're trying to answer in the area of competition is, instead of looking at competition between TLDs, it's this question of how's it affected the retail channel? Because as folks probably know here at ICANN, the registries aren't selling directly to the public. There's the channel through the registrars. And so has the introduction of these new GTLDs affected competition between registrars in the way that they approach the general public? And then the last question we identified is a broader one, which is simply, do consumers actually know about these things? Are they aware enough that it can actually allow for competition? Because obviously, if you don't know that the service or product exists, you can't go out and try to buy it. So those are the key questions that we've identified as the high priority topics. I see Jeff raising his hand, but can I ask you to hold off just a minute? Jeff, we'll go through the other topics and then come to questions. Pardon? Yeah, I got two more slides, and then I'll get you there. Yeah. So the other area that our sub-team's looking at is the topic of consumer choice. And so we've identified three high-level questions that we want to answer there. The first one is basically, is further segmenting and regulating the namespace that we have, is it valuable to consumers navigating the namespace? And this is really a question of, okay, so now there's a domain, you know, there's a .pharmacy and it's limited just to pharmacies, and there's a .photography that's not really limited to anyone, but maybe you could guess based on looking at something that there's going to be photographs on it, and you know, and so on. We have all these new TLDs that are sort of slicing up the namespace and giving it some segmentation and differentiation that we didn't have before. Is that actually useful to people who are navigating around the internet to actually help them find the content they want to? Obviously, this also applies to people registering domains to a certain extent, but we think that gets captured a little bit more in the competition topic by having those names available. The second question is, has the fact that we have all these new choices available, has the benefits of those choices outweighed the costs of introducing these new gTLDs? And in particular, does it outweigh the cost of potential confusion? Because in the past, people are used to sort of a relatively small and stable set of gTLDs. And does the fact that we have so many more, does it add value in terms of the ability to find new stuff, or does it just make it harder to find things, is another question that we'll be taking a look at. And then the last question that we'll look at is essentially, have consumers in either in different regions or who speak different languages or use different scripts, have they all benefited either equally or have they benefited in different ways, right? And so are people in North America getting the same benefits out of the program that people in Africa would be, or people that speak English getting the same benefits as people that speak Thai from the program? And in particular, are they getting the same options, the same level of choice and options available to them? The other sort of follow-up question of that is, even if the TLDs and the domains themselves sort of give them more options, do they actually have places they can go buy the names or the registration options available to them? And we'll be taking a look at both of those questions. So those are the key questions. These are the set of questions we've defined as high priority that we're really going to be focusing our initial inquiry on. And then have another set of questions that we've identified as being lower priority for various reasons. So one example of that would be have different types of TLDs. Like there's, as people may know, some applicants came in representing communities and applied as a community. Other applicants other new gTLDs are geographic in nature. So .Berlin or .NYC would be examples of those geographic names. And now there's many .brands as well. Are these different types of TLDs, are they adding choice and competition in different ways? That's an interesting question, we think, but not quite as important as just overall whether we see more competition. So if we have time, we'll get to this one, but we've identified it as a little bit lower priority than the other things that we're looking at. Another separate question is a lot of the new registries are doing different things than just first come, first serve in terms of how they distribute names to people. Some of them have auctions up front or reverse auctions. Some of them have premium price lists. Some of them have special programs where they give names out in advance of the general launch. Are these programs getting domains in the hands of people who are going to use them better or differently than we've seen in the past? Once again, that's an interesting question. It may be too early to really understand the answer to that, and this is also a little bit a harder one to even define what it means to better allocate names. Another related question is, you know, what's the effect of new technologies like apps or social media on people's use of domain names? Is that making it so that people wouldn't want to use these gTLDs because they're using other technologies instead? We want to take a little bit of a look at the effect of these other technologies and the effect of competition. This one actually feels like there's been a lot of interest in the group, but we've had a very hard time pinning down how to take a look at it. And so this is just one where practicality may get in the way of our ability to really understand the effects here. Related to this, there's just this general question of, is it is it too soon to really figure this out? And I think in a lot of cases we'll find that it is too soon to have authoritative answers about the effects of competition and consumer choice. But nonetheless, we'll be able to get some initial insights, at least, that will be helpful, especially as we note that the GNSO has another PDP underway to figure out whether there should be additional TLDs created in the future. And so some of this information will hopefully be helpful in informing that process, at least. And a couple other sort of related questions are, is there a certain size that a TLD needs to be in order to survive? Do we need to think about the long-term future of these operations? And then also, you know, if we find that there isn't competition, one thing that we'd like to look at, or there hasn't been as effective competition as we would have expected, are universal acceptance issues causing any of that lack of uptake? And once again, if we find that these are robustly deployed and people are using them, we don't really need to necessarily get to that question. So that's roughly what we plan to look at. I think here's our chance to sort of pause if people have questions of clarification or even better, suggestions of things that we ought to be looking at that haven't made the list. That would be great to hear now. And I guess we'll start with Jeff because he's wanted to be in the queue quite a while ago.
Thanks. Jeff Newman. One of the issues, and I just to get it on the record, but I said it before in the CCT meeting, but just to get it on here, is I think one of the issues that you probably should look at is you know, how registrar separation rules have either helped or hindered competition, and or whether are there parties going around the rules? I mean, I don't know how exactly you phrase it. You could phrase it better, but I think it was always intended that there'd be a set of separation rules in this current, I could say it, this current round, but I think it was always intended that it would be analyzed and reviewed so that we could see, are these restrictions or lack of restrictions appropriate going forward?
Thanks, Jeff. You're right. That is an oversight that in our set of topics on competition, we didn't include the notion of what the effects of registrar separation were. I think that is an important topic, and we'll definitely make sure that gets added to the list. I think we've got someone else in the audience. Come up. Join us at the table.
Hi, my name is Alex. I work for Center. For CCTLDs in Europe, we have noticed that several of our members use the HHI, the index, to assess the competition in their own markets. So just to say that data would be available and might be interesting to integrate.
Yes, thank you. That would be very helpful. We got some initial information from Center just earlier today, I think, and or last night. Oh, we've been getting ongoing information. We got some additional information very recently. I don't know. I'm not an economist, so I don't know particularly what the right measures are, but I have heard the economists on the team express interest in measuring HHIs in various different ways. That's certainly something that we want to take a look at. The other thing I'll note is that one of the questions we're trying to get at when we define, like, what is a market is this notion of, like, is there competition between GTLDs and CCTLDs? Are these standalone? Is the market really like a country? Or is it, you know, is it all of Europe? Or, you know, what is it? How are people thinking about what their alternatives are when they go to register? So that sort of data, we certainly appreciate the offer of helping supplement the review with it. So I think Carlos wants to make a brief comment as well.
Yes, to Jeff's comment, it's interesting that the analysis report has analyzed the whole value chain, the cost of the domain name as compared with the whole product of having a website and email and all those things. So I think it should not be restricted just to registries and registrars, but there are some hints of the relevance of the full cash cost to the registrant.
Alice?
Thank you, Jordan. There's a question in Adobe Connect from a remote participant, Aaron Pace. The biggest thing that consumers are constantly dealing with over any TLD is abusive advertising practices. There is a way to resolve this issue from a top-down approach using .less website extensions. Question is, would there be any interest from this group to become advertising standards board members to oversee and make advertising better for consumers? End of question.
So I actually think that may serve as a good segue, if we don't have any other questions, to the next topic area, which is safeguards and consumer trust, which I think touches very much on that sort of topic. So why don't I defer that question to Laureen in just a moment, but, and make sure that we don't have any other questions related to competition and consumer choice before we kick that discussion off. Seems like no, so we'll call that the perfect segue and turn things over to Laureen.
Thanks, Jordan. So I'm going to be focusing on our safeguards and consumer trust issues, and it's going to be basically to give a very high-level summary for folks about some preliminary areas that we've identified so far. And this is an opportunity, since I use the word preliminary, for folks in the audience and in the audience wherever you are, even if you're not here physically, to give us some feedback if you think we've missed some big picture areas. And I want to emphasize that we do consider this to be an evolving process. We are just at the start of our process, so we'll know a lot more later than we do now, and we're not so arrogant to realize that there are things that we don't know. So this may change, but for now, we would welcome your feedback. And with that, I'll ask Jonathan to advance the slides. So these topics that you see before you, and I'll read them out loud as well, are sort of our big buckets of issues. First, can the public safely navigate to and use new GTLDs? It should be there's an extra word there. But second, impact of PICs, and that means public interest commitments and safeguards. And just as an aside, many of the advice on safeguards advised by the GAC are actually put into the contracts regarding new GTLDs through the public interest commitments in the contracts. So that's why these are grouped together. Three, the risk of confusion and DNS abuse. Four, issues regarding developing countries, and five, trademark issues. So those are kind of five big buckets that touch in different ways on either the issues of consumer trust or safeguards. But what I want to do next is put a little more meat on the bones for those big topic areas. So regarding safe navigation and use, at a basic level, one of the big questions we're going to be asking is, can the public reach the destination they intend to reach when they're navigating to a new GTLD? Is the destination safe? And another topic we've identified is consumer literacy. How much do consumers know about new GTLDs? We see that as an important threshold issue. As an example of an issue under consumer literacy is what expectations do consumers have for GTLDs whose names carry more information than they have in the past? A .com and .org name is very different from a .email, .photo, .bank, .pharmacy name. So we ask the question of what expectations are created for the public. Another literacy question is, do consumers know where to go to report problems? So that's just an example of that issue. Moving on to you don't need to advance the slide because I'm just going to go to the right. The impact of the public interest commitments and safeguards. We are considering the issue of the role of the safeguards in the new GTLDs. The new GTLDs have a lot more safeguards knitted into the contracts than the legacy GTLDs do. And what kind of impact has that had? And again, these safeguards are being implemented through the public interest commitments. We're interested in how those are being enforced. And then, as I indicated, there's a whole spectrum of new GTLDs, ranging from GTLDs that are very general in their name and cover general topics like email or photo, to GTLDs that actually are in highly regulated sectors like banks or pharmacies or accountants, for example. So we're interested in asking whether those public interest commitments have had an impact on consumer trust. Next slide, please. Okay, and then moving on, our third big picture topic is the risk of confusion and DNS abuse. Our first question there, you'll see, is consumer confusion over similarly named strings. There's now lots of opportunities for similarly named strings, everything from singular and plural to a string that has a .com ending, say like bikes.com, to something that might be named bikes.bike or capenbikes.com or capenbikes.bike. There's a lot more opportunities for confusion, and does that have an impact on the public's trust? And then there's more what I'll term as conventional, what we conventionally think of as DNS abuse, botnets, farming, phishing, and malware. And some of the data that we have and that we're going to continue to gather more data on really speaks to those issues, comparing the legacy GTLDs to the new GTLD space. And finally, not yet. Wait, there's more. We also want to look at developing countries. That's going to be a big topic, especially in the application process. But if we look at it through the lens of the public's trust in new GTLDs, we ask the question, has the low participation of developing countries in the new GTLD process, has that had an impact on the public's willingness to trust and use the new GTLDs? So that's another issue we're looking at. And finally, there are some trademark issues that can also that also may have an impact on consumer trust. Pricing models, the absence of restrictions. For example, does the absence of restrictions, which can lead to low prices in certain instances of new GTLDs, does a low price mean that there may be a higher incidence of abuse in that GTLD, or maybe it means the opposite? But do these pricing models have any impact on the level of abuse that takes place? And then rights protection mechanisms are also an issue that we'll be taking a look at. So those are kind of a little more meat on the bones of our big bucket of topics. But what I'd like to ask you right now is if you have additional topics for us or feedback on the topics we've already described. Now's the time to jump in. Yes.
Thanks, Jeff Newman. If you go back to the PICS one, or the, I think it's one more, impact of PICS. I guess one thing that's not on here, or what this seems to assume, and you could correct me if I'm wrong, it seems to assume that PICS and or safeguards are actually necessary or appropriate? Is there some kind of study that will show whether those PICs and or safeguards actually added trust to those TLDs? Or whether it's still the same as no difference between the legacy TLDs?
What the there's already data on comparing some of the new gTLDs to the legacy gTLDs. I think it's an inference then to say what will be causing any differences between the level of abuse found in both, whether that is a result of the public interest commitments or not. Right now, there is not a defined study on the question that you're asking. I'd be interested in hearing more about how you think that could actually be measured.
Well, I look to the economists to figure out how it should be measured. I guess my point is that, you know, it was such a, and it still is. I mean, there's a lot of, what's the word I'm looking for? There's a lot of discussions, let's put it that way, on safeguards and how important they are and how they're needed to create a more trust in the community with TLDs. If the economists or you all could figure out a way to measure whether those safeguards are actually leading to the intended results of what the GAC is trying to achieve, if there's some way to measure that. And again, I leave that to you all on how to measure, but that's one question. And again, one way to do that is to say, you know, have the PICs made a material difference in trust between the new TLDs that have the PICs and the legacy gTLDs that do not have the PICs? On the confusion and abuse, one question is with respect to the new registrar accreditation agreement requirements for 2013. Is that right? Yeah. 2013 RAA. Again, because these are all things that were added to the new TLD requirements because of trust, right? To improve trust and safety in the new TLDs. You know, did the new RAA requirements actually result in lower abuse? Or, you know, did the RAA requirements actually result in did it have unintended consequences? So there's a registrars put out a study or a paper. I don't know if it's a formal study, but they put out a paper a couple meetings ago saying that there were over a million registrations that were deleted as a result of the verification requirements. If there could be some sort of study as to whether that was a good thing, a bad thing, or were there unintended deletions. Things like that. I think this is a good opportunity to prove the thesis that it makes for a safer space. And then one thing I didn't see on here, another, maybe this is a different study because I know there's a DNS abuse study separate and probably don't want to duplicate, but I'm assuming that one of the studies will look to name collision and whether the rules that whether the delay and the rules that came about as a result of the debate actually resulted in greater trust in the space.
Thanks for those questions. I'm not sure I understood the last one.
So name collision, there was an argument raised and measures put in that said that if we put, and Jordan can help me on this one, but if we put a name into the root immediately, there would be an increased chance of collisions with systems that have been implemented in a way. Jordan, help me out.
Yeah, so I think the issue is that there was some perception or some risk identified that there were existing legacy systems that made use of some of the same domain name space that was being allocated through the new gTLD program. And there was some concern that those legacy systems, when instead of this being a private domain name space that was just used by these legacy systems, suddenly there was the public DNS was capable of resolving them around, that various bad things or unexpected things would happen, and it wasn't really clear exactly, you know, there were various hypotheses what these would be or how bad it would be, but no one really knew. And so ICANN proposed as a mitigation mechanism this method by where registry operators were asked to temporarily cause the domains to give it errors that would cause the systems to fail in more predictable ways in order to identify the problems before we started making general use of them. And I think, Jeff, you're asking, did that actually succeed in improving trust in the system and alleviating the concerns about these potential collisions with legacy systems? Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Because I think if you go back into the record, one of the reasons it put those measures in place was to increase trust in the DNS, also security and stability. But trust was one of the rationales for implementing that. And the same token, I guess, this could be a trust issue or a DNS abuse issue, but trust was often used as one of the primary reasons for the implementation of DNSSEC. And so has the implementation of DNSSEC led to a greater trust in the namespace? Again, I have no idea how you measure that, but it was hypothesized as being one of the reasons for the implementation of that protocol.
Hi, this is Jonathan. The issue there might be one of just scope. I'm not sure that the implementation of DNSSEC is necessarily about the new GTLD program, even though there might have been a priority to implement it, but that's happening in parallel, the DNSSEC implementation. But are there other questions, just because we want to wrap up on this section and move on? Yeah.
Yeah, David Taylor. Jeff, I was just going to come back to your point there where you made about the PICs and the safeguards and whether, because I think it's an important one, that we can measure whether there's an increase in trust over the legacy TLDs. And I think it's something which we certainly want to be looking into, but I think it's something which it's one of the issues we face generally, is it's very early in the process to be getting good, relevant data on that to be able to make decisions and conclusions. So I think that's something which, especially the economists.
Steve Metallitz.
Thank you, Steve Metallitz. I had a couple of questions or points about the PICs and safeguards, and I guess a couple of reactions to what Jeff was just saying. I guess my first question is, do you one thing you might distinguish here, well, it's not on that slide, but you might distinguish between the mandatory and the voluntary PICs, because it would be interesting to look at what additional obligations or additional safeguards some new GTLD registry operators took on and whether those made a difference. I take the point that was just made that it is early days and it may be hard to measure a lot of these things, but it, to the extent they are measured, that might be something to look at. My second question was, I see that the board in a letter to the GAC last month said that it can recommend that community reviews of the current round of the new GTLD program, which I assume means this, review, consider whether and how to commend PICs and identify best practices. So maybe that's inherent in what you're talking about, that if you find something that seems effective, you might say this is a best practice or it should be continued. But the other point that the board made in response to the GAC was that it will recommend to each of these groups consider whether and how various elements of the community should devise appropriate PICs for the next round of the new GTLD program. I'm not sure that falls in your bailiwick, but I wondered if you had had any discussion about these requests from the board, or whether you've received these requests from the board, since they sent them to the GAC, but I don't know that they've actually told you. So that was really my questions about PICs. I did want to respond to one thing that that Jeff said, but maybe I should just stop and let you respond to that.
In terms of us being communicated with directly, I think unless Jonathan is aware of something, I think the answer is no. I'm personally generally aware of some of those issues. And I think the broad issue generally about the public interest commitments, which includes not just the mandated ones, but the ones that have been voluntarily taken on, are certainly on our radar screen. And that's something that we want to look at and consider. And as you mentioned, these ideas of best practices and commended examples, I think that's something that might flow from whatever conclusions the review team reaches. But I'll leave it at that. I certainly think that it's relevant.
And Jonathan, if I may, just the last point on Jeff's point about verification requirements and how that's affected. I mean, if I understood what you were asking about, I'm not sure I see that as a new GTLD issue, since most of the registrations that had to be verified were in the legacy GTLDs, if you're talking about the RAA verification requirements. But that's maybe I misunderstood your point.
Yes, thanks. It's Megan Richards for the record. I'm a member of the GAC. I just wanted to go back to the first committee that you proposed. So that was something that the ICANN board had suggested would be a committee that was established between ALAC, the GNSO, and perhaps others to look at best practices in existing PICs and where and how those could be used even better in the current group of new GTLDs. And then, as Laureen said, we're also looking, and her subgroup is looking at this in even more detail. So I just wanted to clarify that there are two aspects to this, that we'll have to look at the data and see how, to what extent we can really identify how these PICs have been useful and how they've been applied. And also they've been applied and requested particularly for the highly regulated strings. So it's not everything that should have a PIC, or PIC should be just thrown out. It was really a targeted audience. Thanks.
Jeff?
Yeah, thanks for that. I think what I can use the term PICs much broader than the safeguard advice from the GAC. So there's a specification 11 where there is, it's basically nicknamed the PIC spec. It includes, for the highly regulated strings or sensitive, sorry, I might not be using the right term, it does include the ones recommended from the GAC, but there are a couple others that were recommended by the GAC for all TLDs, including things like a technical analysis should be performed on each TLD to check for botnets, malware. That applies to all, and they're technically called PICs, but they're not necessarily what the GAC refers to as PICs. The other thing on the, just to respond to Steve, the reason I grouped it in, the 2013 with the new TLDs, is because if you go back, basically ICANN said the only way you could sell new TLDs is if you sign the 2013 RAA. So I grouped it in together. Maybe it's a separate issue, maybe not. But that again is something that when ICANN goes around saying these are all the things we've done in the new TLDs, that's why, and why the new TLDs are more trustworthy, I think they use the 2013 as REA as one of the things that lead people to believe that there's more trust in the new GTLDs. So that's why I suggested, not because I felt one way or the other.
Hey, thank you. And I guess I'll also add, for the benefit of Aaron Pace, we'll take on the recommendation of looking at the question of advertising in the trust team. And as far as sitting on a board or anything, that would be somebody's individual decision. But We'll certainly take on your recommendation to look at the advertising issue. So this is Jonathan Zook again, for the record. So the third sub-team on the review team has to do with the application evaluation process. And so the way this was structured at the outset, these have not been normalized between each of them. But the way this was structured in the first place was to ask the question, was the application evaluation process effective at? And then there were several high-level dependent clauses. So the first was addressing the needs of the underserved areas and markets. So did it serve different communities? Did it encourage participation? as providers from within the area, providing effective dispute resolution for developing regions where there are barriers to entry for prospective participants from emerging economies, IDNs, application support. So those are the issues that kind of fall under that. And was that effective? And, you know, the fact that there only ended up being, you know, one application support application that was granted and they withdrew would suggest that that wasn't an effective tool. So we'll try to look at why. Was the application evaluation process effective at preventing the delegation of TLDs that would be confusing or harmful? So the standing and objection process, the string confusion resolutions, singular plurals, which is related, inconsistent decisions and appeals. And so we're trying to figure out whether that last bit's in scope of our review. But again, looking at that evaluation process to see if it prevented confusing strings from being added. Was the application evaluation process effective at allowing specific communities to be served by a relevant TLD? So how we define the community applicants and design an evaluation process fit to purpose, IDNs, et cetera. In other words, something that comes up a lot is .cat, for example. Was that effective in serving that particular community? So community applicants is something that is widely discussed in the group, and we'll be trying to figure out how to evaluate the success of the application process, of application evaluation process for community applicants. Was the application evaluation process effective at providing equal opportunity for participation in the program? So was there, did it get driven too much by money? Were companies that were better funded have the ability to kind of disadvantage those that that couldn't afford to participate equally? Were there linguistic barriers to participation in the new GTLD program? Was there sufficient outreach and awareness so that people knew that the program was even going on or what was involved in trying to participate in the program? And then finally, was there sufficient infrastructure access for people around the world to have access to the new GTLD program? And then the other question is whether the application evaluation process was effective at collecting and implementing GAC public policy advice. In other words, did that synergy, did that connection work as efficiently as it could have? Public interest commitments, voluntary versus mandated? Was there enough early participation by the GAC? And was GAC advice effectively formulated for delivery to the new program? So this, again, is examining that relationship of GAC to the policy development process, and is there some improvements that could be made there that would have allowed that advice to be taken on in a more efficient manner? So those are sort of the high-level topics that we're talking about in the application process. And the same as the other two, if you have questions and discussion topics, suggestions for things that we haven't thought of, et cetera, then now's the time to bring them up.
Jonathan, we do have a comment from remote from Lori Schulman. She says, Jeff's point about the PICs is well taken. INTA members have bumped up against the enforcement of the PICs, particularly in pricing screams. ICANN has taken the position that enforcing a PIC is a private remedy for aggrieved parties to exercise rather than a responsibility of ICANN. So an analysis of enforcement of PICs could be very helpful for setting recommendations and guidance in the future. And Lori, she corrected herself. She said schemes, not screams.
Right. Thanks, Lori, for your input. And that is sort of some of the things that are at the center of this discussion. And enforcement of PICs is part of a lot of discussions here at ICANN, but it will certainly come up in this context as well. Other questions or comments?
One more from Lori. She says, although we have screamed about schemes, she just wanted to add that.
Thank you for the emphasis, Lori.
Nick Wood. Two probably very simple questions. When we look at rights protection measures, will we be looking at the registry introduced measures as well as the ICANN ones? So DPML. That's a yes, I think.
Good question. I think that we will look at because we're going to be looking, that's why we tried to ask these questions this way, and I mean, maybe that was worthy of some introduction. There was sort of a process up way of conducting the review, or goals down way of looking at the review. And to some extent, we looked at sort of the goals down approach that will effectively create the narrative for the review. And so if things naturally evolved and happened organically as part of the process, whether or not that they were part of the new GTLD program implementation itself, we'll still be able to conclude that something worked or didn't work in the new GTLD program.
Thank you. And this might be completely stupid, but I've been very interested in the sets of applications, and I was jotting down just now the ones that I could remember relating to shopping, and these are the ones I can remember: shop, shopping, store, boutique, online shopping in Japanese. When we're looking at consumer choice and competition, is there some way of evaluating or looking at the kind of value of some of these as opposed to others? Why do people choose one, not others? Is it useful in the future to have these kind of sets being replicated? That might be out of scope, and it might. I'm not an economist.
Yeah, thanks, Nick. It's Jordan Buchanan again. I actually think that's the heart of one of the questions that we've identified in the consumer choice section, which is essentially, does the value of having these additional options outweigh the potential confusion that comes from having these potential options? So we will be taking a look at it. You're right that it's maybe hard to get it at the right data. We are, one of the sets of data that we'll have is Nielsen's going to be fielding surveys of both internet end users as well as registrants to help understand their experiences interacting with these domain names. So that may be some of the best data that we have, just to ask people what they think about the changes that they've seen.
And Nick, this is Jonathan again, for the record. Related to that is the market definition question, too, because one of the things we're grappling with is how to define the market or the markets that we might want to explore. And if you look at the first version of the analysis group report that they're now about to do the second phase of, they made an attempt to look at one potential market segmentation just as you did. So there's a bunch that are for shopping, there's a bunch that are for photography, and did they create their own markets and therefore competition within them? And what the outcome of that competition is, we don't yet know, but because those are more effective substitutes for each other than music is for shopping, for example, right? And so having, one economist said, making sure that apples and apples are competing rather than apples and oranges.
Yeah, and one thing I'm interested in on that is the value of going first, of being first out the blocks, because that was a big concern and that impacted on the process we designed before. And I'm not sure if there's any value in being first.
Jeff, go ahead.
Jeff Newman. One thing you may look to for the markets, if you probably have already, when the .com agreement was up in 2006, 7, 8, somewhere around there, there was an analysis done by the Department of Justice that was required. I guess the Department of Commerce was asked for its thoughts, and it asked the Department of Justice when it was talking about whether it should allow .com to increase its price and all those questions. And the Department of Justice did come out with a formal opinion as to how it defined the markets. That might be useful to refer to. I can find that if you guys don't have a copy of it. But that's certainly interesting, because that was what was used to justify the allowance in the first agreement of .com being able to raise its price, but then not being allowed in the second agreement. So there were some studies that were done there. I got the opportunity to discuss this with the CCT review team. We recognize that there's overlaps between several PDPs that are going on. The one we talked about was overlap in subjects of the subsequent procedures PDP, and you know, we're going to work closely with the CCT review team in order to not duplicate efforts and figure out the best way forward. The other one is the one that was just I assume was approved by the GNSO, I don't have a definitive answer, is the rights protection mechanisms, PDP. So is there a particular angle that you all have on looking at the rights protection mechanisms that would be different than the policy development process would be looking at? In other words, would you be looking at just the overall question as to whether the rights protection mechanisms helped in creating greater trust? I don't know, I'm trying to come up with something. Whereas the PDP may be looking at the specific procedures itself and whether that was effective. Maybe not. I don't know if you've thought about that yet.
Thanks for the question, Jeff. And I think it falls in the same category as it does with the subsequent procedures PDP, that we have to sort of figure out what that overlap is and how best to segment that work. I think you started to get to that notion of whether or not the things that were put in place were effective protections for trademark owners, for example, and probably we're looking at that at a macro level and looking at costs, defensive registrations, things like that, and the PDP team may be looking at that at more of a micro level in terms of whether or not the source of that was the non-workability of the trademark clearinghouse or something like that, but we'll be looking overall at whether or not those things were effective in representative effective protection for brand owners. Other questions? Denise, come on down.
Hi, Denise Michelle with Facebook. I also sent an email to the review team. I got a bounce message. I'm not sure it went through, so I thought I would highlight it here. So there's several initiatives, studies, reviews, and other things that seem to have some connection potentially with your work. So I wanted to highlight those. I think those are in the email. Specifically, though, on the new GTLD implementation report issued by staff, the business constituency had a number of substantive suggestions for the draft implementation report. I think for whatever reason, many of those weren't incorporated, but I still think they're relevant and useful and potentially for consideration by the review team, so I would call your attention to those and perhaps other comments that were provided on the draft implementation report. And then I also have a question. In late January, staff had a couple of conference calls and issued a questionnaire on DNS abuse. I don't think very many people were aware of it, and I was wondering if you're coordinating with staff that's working on that, and if there might be an extension or a further exploration of that space by the CCT review team. Thanks.
So thanks, Denise. We did get your email, and I think we will look at other things beyond just the staff report on implementation, including reconsideration requests and other outside things. So we'll look at the BC comments. So thank you for that. And then as far as whether or not the review will expand the look at DNS abuse, definitely the case. We haven't figured out all the ways we're going to do that, but we're definitely going to look at that from a number of different angles. Karen?
Thanks, Jonathan. This is Karen Lentz for the record. Just to amplify a couple of points that Denise was raising on the program implementation review report that was done by staff, that was obviously one of the inputs provided to this review team. It's somewhat rare for staff to create a report like that's substantive, and so we kind of went around on several ways of the best way to present it or representing it without being misleading or confusing about whose perspective it was, and so most of the comments we received or all of the comments we received are described and analyzed in the report of public comments, which is also provided to you with the report. So I just want to make it clear that that's the comments that the BC made and others made are part of what's been delivered to you. On the second question about the DNS abuse review activities, We had, envisioned this on a similar track to what we had done earlier in the process with gathering information on the rights protection mechanisms, for example, that would be, again, an input to this report. It's starting at a later point, but it's a similar type of exploration where we would get, collect what data we have, get public comment, which we'll also do, and deliver that to the review team, which would then determine the next steps on that. Thanks.
Thanks, Karen. Any other questions? So those of you that are online, you can see from the slide that there is an email address to send additional recommendations for topics, data sources, et cetera, that we should be looking at, or just to send us your best wishes. So please feel free to email that. I will also say that all of the sessions of the CCT review are open for observation by the public. So there will be these sort of shadow Adobe Connect rooms in which you can come and listen in on a conversation. There's not a way to interact with it because they're working sessions, but you would then take your reactions and send them to this email or to your designated representative on the team. Is that it? That might be it. Oh, and here's our picture. So thanks, everyone. We're just really at the early stages of our work here, but appreciate people coming forward and having these discussions. There's a lot going on at ICANN at the same time, and we just need to figure out the way that we can be most useful to the process going forward. Thanks a lot, everyone, and have a good evening.